Morning, Francis.
Good morning, Mark. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm great. We're going to talk about wine today. We've got Natalie McLean coming on the show in just a little bit. But I wanted to start off talking about something, a new wrinkle, and I hope they don't bore you at all with the high fructose corn syrup.
You do frequently bore me.
But not with this, I hope. Marion Nessel had a wonderful entry on her blog, and her opinion on high fructose corn syrup is a little different than ours. But
how
here,
dare she?
And she does so many wonderful things, but we disagree a little bit, and here's where it really comes to light. She makes a very, very good point where she says that high fructose corn syrup now accounts for about half of the empty calories we consume in the high fructose corn syrup versus sucrose, which is sugar.
In the sugar count.
In the sugar count.
And high fructose corn syrup is a form of sugar. I don't dispute that.
And what she's saying is, what she says is, listen, stop worrying about whether it's high fructose corn syrup or sugar. Just, you're eating 20 pounds a year too much of it. So cut it out.
But see, I guess my issue here and with both what Marion says and how America has approached this, we don't just use high fructose corn syrup anymore as sugar. We use it as a preservative. We use it to make foods more juicy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. We're putting it in every single food that we eat. So we're eating so much more of this than we ever did of sugar before high fructose corn syrup came into the market.
Well, we eat, you ready for this? We consume about 60 pounds of sugar a year and 60 pounds of high fructose corn syrup a year.
I would have guessed that.
Holy cow.
I'll bet that those numbers are not correct.
I'll bet
that we eat more corn syrup than sugar as an
Remember, issue. I never doubt Marion Nessel's numbers, man. She'll mess you up. And remember, though, that high fructose corn syrup, pound for pound, is sweeter than sugar.
Mm-hmm.
So here's her point. Her point is there's a lawsuit. Well, what's occasioned this blog post was there's a lawsuit that's been filed by the Sugar Association, which markets sucrose derived from cane and sugar beets. And they're fighting the Corn Refiners Association in the Corn Refiners' bid to change the name of high fructose corn syrup on the labels mm-hmm. to corn sugar. And the beet sugar and cane sugars who produce sucrose mm-hmm. are saying, hey, wait a second. Okay, you guys got a bad rap and people don't want your product anymore, so you get to change your name and call yourself corn sugar?
I have two issues there. One, the corn sugar is not sucrose like beet sugar and cane sugar is.
Right.
Okay, it's not exactly the same
chemical
compound. Okay, well, it's
fructose
a combination.
And sucrose unbound.
It's a combination, exactly.
Right.
My second issue is, you're changing this name in order to deceive the public.
That's the problem. See, my problem.
Okay, obviously that's the bigger issue.
Right,
the bigger
right.
issue is the purpose of this is to hide the fact that people who don't want high fructose corn syrup is to hide this from them.
Yeah, and where I think Marion Nessel gets the point right, we eat too much sugary stuff, whether it's high fructose corn syrup or sugar. I don't like high fructose corn syrup. I'd like to remove it from my diet. Marion Nessel says it doesn't make a difference, Francis. Just reduce the overall intake of sugar in whatever form you have it, whether it's high fructose corn syrup or sugar. I get her point. I think she has a valid point there. I choose to live my life differently. I choose when I am going to consume sugary empty calories, I want it to be sucrose more than high fructose corn syrup. And another reason for me is, and I know many taste tests have been promulgated that say that you can't taste the difference. I believe I can. Whether or not I'm right, I have a right to put into my body what I want to put into my body.
Right.
And I have a right to avoid putting in my body something that I don't want there, whether you think my reason for doing it is stupid or not, okay?
I think your reasons for doing things are stupid often.
If you're from a religion that says, I don't want pork, okay, should I be able to rename pork a dog? You know, I mean, no. Or just say mammal meat, you know, and then, well, it's a mammal, you know, and it's not lying. No, when you put pork in something, you have to label it pork so that when people want to consume pork, they can. And if they have an objection, maybe if I'm Hindu, I want to avoid eating beef.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do I get to rename beef, you know, mammal meat? Or do I say, you know, or do I get to call it, switch it to bovine because some of the population's not going to know what bovine means?
Yeah.
The idea here...
It's purely... to deceive.
Absolutely.
And that is the crux of why Francis and I are totally against this.
And I think
and pushing hard the other way because it's purely to deceive the public so that they can put their product in without you knowing it.
And I think Marion Nestle really, and she's wonderful and we agree with her on so much stuff and she does so much good work, but she really needs to and whether you think the reasons why behind it are good or not, if we allow industry to change the names of things at will, there's no point in having a debate. There's no possibility of raising consumer awareness against or for anything, because if ever we make people aware of something that they shouldn't be eating,
and change the name.
They'll change the name. They'll call it something else, and we'll have to fight a whole nother battle of awareness. It's really hard to get the word out to 500 million people that, you know, it says corn sugar, and like, oh, yeah, it's a good thing this has corn sugar because I don't want that high fructose corn syrup stuff. You know, people aren't following our blogs every day and listening to our radio show.
Some people are against this simply because they don't believe in corn subsidies and they want to stop, propagating all of this corn production.
Right.
That they think it's bad for the earth to produce this much corn.
Right. And in any event, the idea is you can't just change the name because, and you know, when you listen to their PR spin on it, it's like, well, people have misperceptions about high fructose corn syrup, so we're going to, no, you think it's a misperception. I see, when we disagree about something, you think I have a misperception, I think you have a misperception, but you know, you don't get to change the name. Sorry. Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment. We're going to talk about happier things with Natalie McLean. Her new book is Unquenchable, A Tipsy Quest for the World's Best Bargains, none of the names have been changed to protect the innocent. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com and the Heritage Radio Network. Hi there, everybody, and welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. And our guest today is our old friend, Natalie McLean. She is the wine writer from Canada. Her new book is Unquenchable.
Natalie, welcome back to the show. How are you?
It's great to be here, guys. I'm fine.
It's been a long time. You've been on the show a whole bunch of times, Natalie.
Well, I think you guys like to drink as well, don't you?
Yeah, and you're responsible for everything north of the border. Like, you have it all the way up to the Arctic Circle. You're like the wine go-to person for us.
We have to keep warm somehow.
Yeah, exactly. Well, now you've written a number of books. Your wine column, your free wine newsletter now, I understand that, you know, it's a phenomenon, kind of like The Restaurant Guys, through the internet. You hit 125,000 people?
Absolutely, yes, we did that, more than a month ago. It's been really exciting now that the internet is so pervasive, so real, not this sideshow kind of thing anymore. And of course, there's social media. So everything really does spread quickly. And I just find the growth, it amazes me.
Well, I want to ask you about the newsletter because I get your newsletter in my inbox and I don't delete you. so I think it's fascinating because we send out our newsletter as well. And if you want to subscribe to our newsletter, you can go to stageleft.com, and that's our restaurant, and you can get on our newsletter there. But, you know, I'm amazed now, like you said, this started out as sort of a sideline thing. I think for a lot of people it still is, you know, I go home and I write about what happened in my day, or I write about wine, or I write about something I'm passionate about, and I'm really a banker during the day, but I write about wine at night. You make your living writing about wine. And this wine blog or this wine column that you don't charge for is available exclusively online, and it's widely read. How does that work in your personal life? How does that work in your professional life? Are you able to monetize that sufficiently? I'm really curious about that.
Sure. Well, okay, so we have the website at nataliemclean.com, and that's where folks can get the free newsletter. Like most people who... are online now and making a living at it, you need multiple revenue streams. So there is that old-fashioned book that just came out this month, Unquenchable, and my first book. So there's that. There's advertising on the site. There are some folks who pay for early access to my wine reviews, although the majority, you know, do obviously sign up for the free newsletter. And then I write, oh gosh, about 15 magazine columns. So when you put that all together, and that's paid for work, it does you know, you do make it as a living, and you know, it's I think like others, it's a passion. So I'd rather cobble it together that way than you know, take a full-time marketing job or whatever.
Well, and then not be able to focus on what you love.
And
exactly.
And this is, I mean, this is your endeavor. This is Natalie McLean. You're an authority on wine. And, you know, writing in Canada, and obviously you write for all of North America, and, you know, we're online now, you write for the world, and I, as an American, get your newsletter. How is wine writing, wine buying, wine consuming, the government involvement in the marketplace different in Canada? And does it vary by province, like it does here in the United States, vary by state?
It does. So we've got a patchwork as well. Perhaps not quite as diverse as in the United States, because I'm well aware of your three-tier system that everyone cherishes there. Kidding. But, you know, we do have, some provinces have government monopolies, just as some states do. Others are privatized. And so these days, when you write about wine, you're trying to pick wines that are very widely available for everyone. And that doesn't mean lowest common denominator, but you are always aware that people have very different distribution systems and store stock. So you're always trying to keep that in mind when you recommend. But to that end, that is why I launched mobile apps. And in my mobile apps, of course, I have all the information that's on my website, including thousands of wine reviews. But what we've added to that is a barcode scanner, so that when you are in a liquor store in New Jersey, you can scan the barcode. There's 150,000 barcodes in there, and bring up the information on the wine. So that is really, really helping, you know, this patchwork of distribution.
That's got to add a lot of value, I think, to the consumer.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's, I think, what we've got to do more and more, is figure out how to make the technology work for us, not work for the technology. So, you know, when I look at something, I always think, is it going to make shopping for wine easier, learning about it easier? You know, I think that's why a lot of us are gravitating towards social media. E-newsletters are still important. A lot of people still want to learn that way, but there are lots of others who don't even want that. They'd rather just get your wine picks or your advice on Twitter or Facebook. So you kind of meet people where they're at, instead of always asking them to come where you are, like your website.
Now let me ask, with your mobile app, does this bring up just your writing on the wine, or does it bring up information overall on the wine?
It brings up both. So there are obviously so many wines, thousands and thousands of wines, and although I've been writing about wine for 12 years, I haven't reviewed every one, but what I've tried to do is put all of the information in there that I can, even for wines I haven't reviewed. So you will get, for some, when you scan it, you will get the name of the wine, the vintage, the alcohol level, you know, suggested matches based on the grape, and so on. For others, you'll get my full tasting notes and scores, and for yet others, you'll get both of those and community reviews for that wine.
You know,
so now I welcome people to submit their own take on a wine, and so that will come up as well if there are those community reviews for a wine.
You know, the things that you get there, I find that one of the problems that consumers face very often, and one of the reasons that, you know, old-fashioned restaurateurs like Mark and I and our newsletters are still really very much in demand, and one of the reasons you see more and more, especially in places like Brooklyn where the liquor license laws allow this to be economically feasible, little shops with 150 selections instead of the 10,000 selections you'll find in a large liquor store. One of the things people are looking for is, you know, getting a lot of information isn't hard these days.
Yeah.
Culling that information and making sure you have quality information and having someone to help you with a point of view, or at least to share their point of view with you and to know.
Somebody that you trust. That's exactly the word I was going to use. If someone's been reading your reviews and they taste wines that you like, just like in the restaurants here, if you have a bunch of wines that I've recommended and you enjoy them, you begin to trust me.
Right.
And to be able to have that trust mobilized
cool.
And in a liquor store with you, I think is a good a lot of value.
And the way that if you invite people on your community to contribute to your app, well, at least you know there are other people who like Natalie McLean's taste in wine. You know, so it's you have sort of a home base there. I think that's a really fascinating thing you've got going on there.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad you agree. And, you know, I think there is value in being selective and culling and curating, I guess is the in-word these days, because when I invite the community to review wines on my site, I am watching every review that gets posted, not just for spam and so on, but also that, you know, the quality is there. I don't ask people to be wine experts. I am just looking for their opinions, but I am still looking at every single piece of information that is posted on my site and gets put into the apps as well. So I think that is what people want, because I think one of the key issues in the wine industry is something we call dirty data. And it's not obscene or anything, but it's just a lot of mixed up data when you throw information into an app or a site, because you're trying to collect it broad scale and you're not curating it, you're not editing it. What happens is you start to bring up red Chardonnays from
the Wikipediaizing of your website,
right?
Where anybody can just jump in and
but even Wikipedia is better policed than a lot of these wine websites. And the Dirty Data app, by the way, that's 99 cents. It's a very different. you're not going to find any wine reviews there. I made that up. There's really no Dirty Data app. So why don't
I bet you're wrong.
So there's none that I have any personal experience with anyway. So Natalie, let's we brought you here into the premises to talk of your new book. I should finish the title. It's Unquenchable: A Tipsy Quest for the World's Best Bargain Wines. And let's start with the existential questions, because the restaurant guys always start with the big questions. What is a bargain in today's wine world? I mean, are there bargains at $1,000? Are there bargains, if you get a bottle of Screaming Eagle for $900, is that a bargain? Or does a bargain have to be inexpensive?
Great question. So I think of a bargain as value, and that's that equation between price and quality. Quality for wine being taste. And so what I look for are wines where you get more than what you pay for. And I do think there's a sweet spot range of, say, $10 to $20 where you can find wines that taste twice as expensive as they cost. But that's not to say that those below 10 or above 20 aren't bargains. So that Screaming Eagle could be a bargain for some folks, at the right price, because it's all about what kind of price-quality ratio do you want. I just think, though, that there's a certain point, and it's not a hard line, but call it $30 or $50. Above that, you start to pay for intangible factors when it comes to a bottle of wine, like prestige and rarity and collectability, the intangible. So you're paying for what somebody else wants, not exactly for what you're getting.
Right, not for necessarily what you're going to experience in pleasure on your palate.
Exactly. And so I'm trying to help people spot the bargains, because, there's so many factors contributing to the fact. I mean, everyone loves a bargain no matter what, but, we've gone through a recession. A lot of us have traded down and realized we didn't have to give up great taste. We could still find really good bottles in that price range and don't see the need for trading back up. I mean, I think people still like to splurge occasionally and, for dinner parties or whatever and go higher. But I think if you're someone who loves a glass of wine or two with dinner, that's often the price range you're looking at.
And remember, Natalie's talking about wines here in a retail store. So whatever the number she's giving you in a restaurant, you would expect to pretty much double.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you're looking for a range. Natalie's talking about wines in the $20 to $40 range and wines in the $60 to $100 range if you were in a restaurant.
Right.
So I think there's an interesting point there about finding wines at a lower price point. I want to say that one of the things that happened, we have about 900 selections on our wine list, right? Mm-hmm. And they range from $35 a bottle to, over $3,500 a bottle. And we've found some folks at different points saying, oh my God, so many of these wines are so expensive. And indeed, in our 900 selections, we have 100 selections under 150 selections under $50. I mean, if that was the whole wine list, you'll find restaurants don't have 150 selections under $50. And I people often say, "Well, you have so many expensive wines." I'm like, "Listen, there are 150 wines here that you can find that are relatively inexpensive." And they say, "Well, do you put as much thought into the less expensive wines than as the high end wines?" And
sometimes
I say,
more.
And I say, "You know what? It's really if you were to say to me, Francis, I'd like you to find a great bottle of wine for your list, and you can spend $150 a bottle on it. It's not that hard, to be honest with you.
Right.
You know, but you want to find a great bottle of wine on your list that's going to make somebody say, wow, for $35. Sometimes, you know, we put as much care and love into that, and we're as proud of ourselves as we can be when we find, you know, I got a Trebbiano d'Abruzzo and a Montepulciano d'Abruzzo that are the least expensive wines on my list right now. They're amazing.
Yeah, they're great.
And your book captures a lot of the spirit of this. It's the quest to go out and find, you know, maybe not the Hope Diamond, but, you know, to find a ruby in your own backyard.
Exactly, and that's my thought. It's the thrill of the hunt. And anyone, as you said, can slap down $100 and get a great wine, but it does take a lot of savvy, actually, to hunt out the gems that do taste terrific in that bargain price range. And I think similarly, you know, when it comes to making wine, it's pure snobbery to think that only winemakers who make the badge wines of over $100 are the ones who care most about the winemaking mm-hmm. process. Mm-hmm. I think those who are trying to make terrific, affordable wines care just as much, if not more, because they have fewer resources to work with. Maybe they don't have the expensive French barrels or whatever. So I think we're realizing that, you know, as wine consumption increases and people become more knowledgeable about wine, there's that dawning of, you know, actually it's just fine to look for a great price quality ratio, because it doesn't mean anymore, you know, inexpensive doesn't mean cheap anymore.
We're talking with Natalie McLean, Canada's premier wine writer. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back on the other side, and we're going to talk with Natalie about her current book and her methodology for going to find these bargain wines, and we'll also tell you where you can pick up the book in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com and the Heritage Radio Network. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of The Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. Natalie McLean is our guest. We're talking about bargain wines, which her new book is about. Okay, so in Unquenchable, Natalie, how do you go about finding the bargain wines? What is your methodology for filling 200 and some odd pages with bargain wines? And what do people learn, not only just the wines that you recommended, but how you went about finding them and what you categorize as a bargain wine here?
Well, first of all, I'm a very thorough and hedonistic researcher, so there was a lot of drinking involved or a lot of tasting.
A hell of a job, Natalie, but somebody's got to do it.
It all starts with really liking wine.
Yeah.
That's got to be the beginning.
And then proving it. Right.
Yes. Well, you know, that's the difference between writing the book today and my first book back in 2006, Red, White, and Drunk All Over. I was able to better crowdsource it, so to speak, through my website at nataliemclean.com, because I was able to ask those 125,000 people where they thought the bargain regions were for wines these days. And so I narrowed it down from there. I had thousands of emails back. And then even within the 8 regions that I picked, I was getting their suggestions for wineries to visit. And with these, what I was looking for is not just a great bargain wine, but a great story, because I think that in telling the story of people in the wine industry, passionate, colorful, obsessive, iconic, I could better tell the story of wine itself, and that you would be carried along with the narrative and then realize at the end of the book just how much you had learned. So what I did was look for those terrific regions, and at the end of each chapter, there are insider tips as to why those regions make for great bargain wines. And so one of them, for example, one insider tip is go south. And so often in traditional wine-producing countries like France or Italy, you will pay a lot for the wines in the northern regions, if you think Bordeaux, Burgundy, Tuscany, Piedmont. If you go south to Languedoc, Provence, and Sicily, which are all in the book, that's where the bargains will be.
Interesting.
Yeah, because they've been producing wines for hundreds of years just as well, or just as long, but they were always known as the country cousins, very rustic and so on. But the methods have improved, and now they're getting better exports, and they have fewer rules that increase their costs as their northern neighbors, so they represent terrific bargains on the shelf.
And, you know, your book also has a certain travelogue quality to it as well.
Oh, good. Yeah, I do. I tried to keep in the armchair travel. Whether you're going to eventually go to the wine regions I'm describing, or even if you don't make it, I think people really do love that. And, you know, that's one of the reasons I write about wine and not plumbing parts. It's because vineyards are always in gorgeous regions of the world, and they make for wonderful vacation destinations, whether you're visiting vineyards or often there are terrific restaurants associated with the wineries and so on. So I really did want to keep that aspect pretty strong in there on this book as well.
Well, you talk a lot of, and Francis and I mention this all the time in talking about wine or food or whatever experience you're talking about. Anytime you contextualize an experience, anytime there's a story that goes with it, you have a better ability to remember the details of that experience. And if the details are good, that will help you remember the great experiences you had while you were in the south of France or the south of Italy or even Southern California.
Exactly. And that's what I was searching out with the people. People who would say memorable things. Either they were witty or they were philosophical or something, because they helped me put that place in my mind, and that's what I was looking for my readers. So, you know, when I went to Australia, there's the colorful Wolf Blass, who's really a going concern in his mid-70s, and I'll never drink another glass of his wine without thinking of him, because he's just so, well, he was a bit randy, actually. But
really?
Yeah. He was, he has a red label Cabernet Shiraz, and, you know, the whole interview was a wink and a nudge, and he was just really colorful. But he was pouring this one in his tasting room. He goes, "Oh, I call this wine the leg opener."
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness, really. It's just when you meet people like that, you remember the place and the wines forever. And I think that's why we travel, too, to really implant those sensory memories in our minds.
All right, so I have a question for you. You're traveled the world looking for bargain wines. Here's something I think is really valuable to consumers. How do they spot inexpensive wines that are terrible but in a pretty package are marketed well? What are the terrible cheap wines that are really just cheap and not a bargain at all?
Look for gold embossing. No. Yeah. I wish there were one or even a few simple tricks to remember. It's hard these days because, you know, wine marketing has gotten very sophisticated. It's as sophisticated as any other packaged good these days, especially with mass producers, and not that mass producers only produce terrible wines. So I think I try to advise the reverse. So try to develop a repertoire where you know they are good wines at reasonable prices. And so, you know, back to those insider tips, you know, another way to spot a good wine is, say, a region that had a dismal reputation a few decades ago, but now is really working hard to repair that reputation. And I think of Germany is one, where we had the sweet syrup behind the high school portable, perhaps. Today they produce zippy dry Rieslings, wonderful food wines. You can't read, well, a lot of the labels are still difficult to read if you're a total English-speaking person. But if you start to get familiar with their wines and their styles, you will always pay just a fraction of the cost for other that you would for other great white wines. The other thing, another region would be South Africa. They were out of our market due to apartheid for years, and so they are still trying to make an inroad into our market. That's another one to look for. Another insider tip would be go where it's warm because they have fewer costs. you look at Argentina and Chile, it's a great vintage every year. They're not battling cold and mildew and rot. Labor is inexpensive. Land is cheap. So they've got natural cost advantages.
You know, all of these places, I think it's all good advice, yet none of them would lead you to Canada. Is there any nepotism going on? There's a Canadian wine section in your book here. Is that a little bit of national pride there, Natalie?
It is and it isn't. The reason I included Niagara, and, you know, I could well have included Upper New York State as well with that, is that the wines there, the quality in the bottle, if you compare that to benchmark wines from around the world, is pretty amazing. So in Niagara, of course, we got on the wine map for our ice wines, our dessert wines. But if you look at the dry table wines, especially Riesling and Pinot Noir, and I focused on Pinot Noir, the heartbreak grape because it's so difficult and expensive to grow. Because I think when you buy a bottle of Niagara Pinot Noir and you compare that to Burgundy, I know they're different styles, but you're going to pay a fraction of the price. The challenge with Niagara and a lot of other wine regions, including many states in the United States, is that we don't produce enough to export great volume. So you're not going to see Canadian wines all over the United States.
So you're basically only sending us your crap.
You have to come visit us. That's the point. That's the armchair travel bit. You're going to have to come up and see us sometime.
Nice. You know, another place that Francis and I have found bargain wines, and I'll use that in quotations because sometimes...
By the way, I just want to point out to everyone on the air that you can't see it because Mark doesn't realize in radio you can't see when you put something in air quotes.
I did air quote there.
Air quoting on the radio. Very amusing.
I air quoted bargain wines, and I'll do it again. But quote-unquote bargain wines because sometimes they're very expensive. But one of the things that Francis and I have found are sometimes great producers in what will be declared an off vintage will have to lower their prices because just the vintage won't sell for whatever reason, but sometimes they'll offer still really wonderful wines.
Exactly. They'll declassify their wine into a second label sometimes, and it's because they want to keep the reputation of that flagship brand pristine and consistent year after year if they produce enough. But that's a great insider tip as well. Look for the second labels or the declassified wines because you're getting that same expertise. It's just because they had such high standards, it didn't quite make it into the lead wine. I think of it as, this is kind of girly, but I think of it as like Max Mara and Max Mara Weekend, where so you have a second label like a lot of the haute couture designers have a second label, much more affordable, and yet you're still getting that quality of craftsmanship.
So I'm guessing that the other men in the audience are as lost as we are.
Francis and I just looked at each other and were like,
huh?
What kind of wear?
I think we got it from context, though, I'm sure.
Okay, good.
Natalie, I want to go back to talking about your website just for 1 minute. And just something that I see, and Francis and I judge wines, but we generally don't give them a score. Do you feel pressure to kind of race to the market with your scores on a new wine just because you want to be the first person to judge something to get a score on it?
I don't feel a pressure to be the first. I feel a responsibility to be comprehensive so that when you're in the liquor store, you're more than likely going to find lots of wines I've recommended because that's what people want. That said, if someone sends me a new bottle, you know, fresh off the bottling line, I'll post my review as soon as I can. But, you know, I think the greater service is to have reviews for most of the wines you're likely to pick up in the store and go, I wonder if this is any good.
You know, it's way too much work, but Mark and I have often toyed with the idea of coming up with our own scoring system. You know, it used to be the 20-point scale, and then Robert Parker and the Wine Spectator innovated with the 100-point scale, which made wine writing a lot more accessible to a lot of folks. And then I think people obsess a little too much on scores. I think so Mark and I want to come up with the 124-point scale, right? So think of how great that would be. How many wines over 100 points? It's like, I only have 100-point wines in my cellar.
We need that.
I think so. Hey, Natalie, your book is great. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
It's been great chatting with you guys. I hope you have a very wine-soaked holiday.
Yeah, so do we. So
we always do.
Me and all our patrons. Natalie McLean's new book is Unquenchable, A Tipsy Quest for the World's Best Bargain Wines. You can find out more about Natalie, her book, and her website at our website at restaurantguysradio.com. You're listening to us on that website, as well as the Heritage Radio Network. We'll be back in just a moment. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis. That was fun. She is fun.
She is fun. She makes wine fun. She keeps it in perspective.
Yeah.
She doesn't take it too seriously like you should be when you're talking about wine.
I want to get her recreation. App, actually.
I'm sure it's great.
I want to get her app.
I'm sure it really is terrific. One of the things Natalie talked about early in the show is she talked about the three-tier system that a lot of states here in New Jersey have. States in the United States have, and New Jersey is one of those states that has that state. And I think that we should just spend a couple of minutes talking about that, because I think that a lot of our listeners don't truly, you know, when they talk about, oh, why can't we get wine from California, and that we should get deliveries, and Francis and I feel pretty strongly that kind of upsets the apple cart as far as,
well,
as fairness.
Well, the problem is, so the three-tier system in states that have a three-tier system, the tiers are the producer, the importer-distributor is the middle tier, and then the retailer or restaurateur is the final tier. And, you know, I think three-tier systems are okay. I think states that don't have three-tier systems, where restaurants can buy directly from producers or consumers can buy directly from producers, I think that's great. The problem is some of these states, and New Jersey is the only one, believe me, we've sat on the board of directors of the New Jersey Restaurant Association, we have been involved in this with the Senate hearings about our system, is New Jersey went down a kind of an odd road. Rather than just like New York did, they said, okay, you want a license? And they have a three-tier system there, which it's debatable whether it's good or not, or maybe people want to eliminate that middle tier, maybe it's irrelevant. But in New York, retailers and restaurants have to buy from that middle tier, from those distributors and those importers. And in New Jersey, they do too. If in New York they wanted to back away from it, if in New York they want to make adjustments and changes to it, like letting out-of-state wine shops ship into state without buying from the New York wholesalers, they can make those changes. Because in New York, when you're given a restaurant or a liquor store license, you go in and you apply for license, and you're granted that license for 1 year.
And you pay a fee every year, which we do in New Jersey as well, but it's different.
And you pay that fee every year, and your license is renewed every year so long as you're on good behavior. In New Jersey, so long as you don't have violations against it and disturb the neighborhood and or commit crimes. In New Jersey, we have all of those requirements as well, but the state got greedy. And when they rewrote the state constitution in 1947, they said, we're going to sell liquor licenses. And we'll sell you an in-perpetuity license, and we'll guarantee you that there aren't more. We will never issue a new license unless the population increases beyond a certain point. So it's X licenses per 1,000 people, and or one license per X 1,000 people, and you pay us the market rate for, we'll auction off this license, and then when you want to retire, you sell that license for whatever it's worth 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 20 years from now. Oh, and you can't finance it, because if you do break the law, the
city, we're going to take it away.
We can take it away. So no bank can loan you.
So it can't be collateralized, right, is what Francis is saying.
Yeah, they
so
say it's encumbered.
Right, you can't say, well, the liquor license is $100,000.
I'll put down $100,000.
I'll put down $100,000 and I'll pay the $900,000.
No, you got to come up with $1 million, right? So in New Jersey, it varies by the town that you're in. Camden is an undesirable place to do business, where there are a lot of liquor licenses and very little money. It costs you $50,000, $30,000 to get a liquor license. Montclair, New Jersey, there are not that as many liquor licenses as there are people, and people spend a lot of money up there. $500,000.
Oh, $1 million. In some places, and Montclair,
Cherry Hill is $1 million.
Montclair is one of these places where if you wanted a liquor license today, you would have to buy somebody's existing business,
right,
in order to take that liquor license and use it someplace else.
And the fact of the matter is, a lot of these guys, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 2 years ago, bought the license from somebody else. And so when you've paid $500,000 to be one of five merchants in that town, when somebody says, oh, and you know what? Why don't we? It's consumer freedom. We should let the consumer buy from anybody they want. And I think that's great, as long as you give that guy his $500,000 back. You can't, because the state said, we'll sell you this license for X amount of dollars in perpetuity, that you get it created property and then sold that property. So if the state wants to take that property away in New Jersey, they got to buy it back. And so, yeah, the consumer should have the right to buy from everywhere they want. And so should the winery, or so should the bar or the liquor store.
Yeah, the other side of this, too, is that the restaurant must buy through the licensed middleman,
right,
licensed wholesaler. I have a license, and one of the things that license requires is that I buy from the licensed wholesaler. So, in essence, you could buy, if the laws passed the way some people believe they should be.
Wanted it to, yeah.
You could buy wine directly from the winery cheaper than I could buy it in cheaper than I could buy it and sell it to you.
Because I have to go through a middleman.
Because I have to go through a middleman in order to sell it. And it's and just the system's a little upside down, and I don't really know how to fix it.
Well, I think there are advantages to the systems the way it is. The distributors and the wholesalers and the importers, they do a lot of good work in making sure that great wines are distributed throughout the state.
That's
true. And they add value. The thing is, though, you can't say that I have to abide by the three-tier system, but the consumers in New Jersey don't have to abide by the three-tier system. You can't say that I have to buy from a licensed New Jersey wholesaler, I have to pay New Jersey sales tax, I have to go through all these hoops. But if I opened a liquor store in Delaware, I could ship in without doing any of that stuff.
Right, exactly.
Because why would I stay here? Why would we discriminate against New Jersey merchants like that? So, you know, it's a funny thing. The state went down the wrong road and set up a system.
And every state is different. And that's the other thing, too. Right. It's a very difficult system because every state is a little bit different.
And that's why people, a lot of our folks who are producers get mad. And they say, why is New Jersey so protectionist? We're not protectionist. What we're saying is, if you want to undo this system, you sold me a piece of this system.
Right.
So if you state government want to take away the rights you sold me, well then give me my freaking money back, and you can do whatever you want. I would be happy.
Right. I totally agree.
To
I think
abolish
that,
the three-tier system.
I think that a lot of merchants would feel that way, and not necessarily abolish the three-tier system even, but you would need to pay the merchants back for their liquor license.
I'm happy keeping the three-tier system. I'm happy working the way it is. Mm-hmm. But you can't make me pay and the thousands of licensees pay $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, $700,000, $900,000 a piece. We're talking a lot of mom and pop shops here, and say, oh yeah, that $900,000 liquor license, yeah, now everybody can do it. So you know what that $900,000 liquor license is worth? Nothing. It's worth nothing. It's worth, you know, if anybody can sell, it's worth, you know, $100,000, because you can open a shop, but the guy who can sell it online sells it cheaper and ships it to you. So, that's why there's a lot of confusion out there and a lot of people get upset, but that's the lay of the land. We'd love to know how you feel about it. Why don't you send us an email to mark@restaurantguysradio.com if you're mad and against us. And if you like what we have to say, send it to francis@restaurantguysradio.com. We'll respond in kind. Well, we hope you've enjoyed spending this last hour with the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and restaurantguysradio.com.